I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. China's trade relations with the United States has become a key economic issue in this year's presidential campaign. Meantime, China's Communist Party is embroiled in a political crisis. Last week, the party announced that Bo Xilai, a member of the Communist Party Politburo, would be expelled from the party and face criminal prosecution. He's accused of abusing power, taking massive bribes, and bearing major responsibility in relation to his wife's murder of a British businessman. China's leaders are also preparing for a once-a-decade handover of power that begins next month. Some argue that the Communist Party will survive, but it has another crisis on its hands, and that's an economic one. After 3 decades of growth at about 10%, China's economy is expected to grow at the rate of 7 to 8%. We are also seeing massive worker uprisings across China. There are more organized forms of unrest. So on today's Your Call, we continue our agenda for a new economy series by talking about China's economic slowdown. What does this mean for the Chinese working class and the global economy? What does it also mean for U.S. multinationals? Katie Kwan is Associate Chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. She's worked as a labor specialist there since 1998. Her areas of specialization are labor strategies and the global economy, policies that promote the rights of immigrant workers, and equity for women. And Katie joins us from her office in Berkeley. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Ho-Fung Hung, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. He examines the changing dynamics of global capitalism in the context of the rise of China and other emerging powers from the developing world. He is author of Protest with Chinese Characteristics, Demonstrations, Riots, and Petitions in the Ming-Qing Dynasty. Hi, Ho-Fung. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So, Ho-Fung, let's start off with you. Before we talk about some of these scandals and what's happening with the Communist Party next month, why don't you give us an overview of what's happening with the Chinese economy? Why is it on the decline?
I think the Chinese economy has been doing very well until recently because of the export-driven growth, and then it relied on the consumers in North America and Europe to buy its products. So its export sector has been doing very well until 2008. And after the global financial crisis of 2008, China export sector got into trouble, and then the Chinese government tried to pump up the economy by increasing this debt, finance the investment, building bridges, high-speed rail, and all these infrastructures. And so the economy in the last few years, despite the global financial crisis, has been doing very well. But this the debt finance, the investment is not going to be sustainable in the long run. Now this investment spree is running out of steam, but at the same time, the export sector is not recovering because of the lingering problem in the consumer markets in the global north. So I think it is the fundamental reason why the Chinese economy now is having the slowdown situation.
And Katie, again, after 3 decades of growth at about 10%, the Chinese economy is expected to grow at the rate of 7, maybe 8%. And what would you add to that? Why is this happening?
Well, I think that the Chinese government had already taken steps before 2008 to develop an internal market in China and to try to encourage investors to go to the interior of China, not the eastern coast, but the interior of China to invest, realizing that solely relying on an export economy was probably not a good strategy. And so, for instance, in the garment industry that I have been associated with, government provided subsidies to firms to move inland and would not provide subsidies to firms who stayed on the eastern coast and solely did assembly manufacturing. So I think the government has, had even before the crisis that the other speaker referred to, had already begun to try to develop internal consumer markets.
And what do you think the government will do now?
Well, I think that the government now is going to have to do the same kind of thing that it's been doing, develop the internal markets, but it is also looking to increase its outsourcing overseas. And I think that one important thing that it's going to have to grapple with is China going to be the sweatshop of the world, so to speak, as it has been in the past 20 or 30 years. So if it's not going to, as wages are rising, it's not going to be able to use this to attract foreign investment. And how is the Chinese economy going to grow when wages are higher?
And Hofeng, how is this economic slowdown affecting the Chinese people, specifically the working class?
I think one key issue is the finance of the local government, that in the previous few years that the state bank is very generous in handing out loans to this local government to build different kinds of infrastructures. But now that the investment spree has and also this infrastructure construction create a lot of jobs that make up for the loss of jobs in the export sector. But at the same time, that many of these state banks now found that they might have a bad loans, non-performing loans problem. So and many local government is already very heavily indebted. So they become more cautious in terms of handing out loans to new projects and giving green light to new projects. In this situation, many of the infrastructure under construction that we already see over the past few months in the Chinese official medias, some construction projects just cannot continue without continuous financing, and new project cannot get started. So it might eventually have an impact on the employment situation.
I also read, this is kind of an amazing number to think about, that within a generation, this is according to Forbes, China's middle class will be four times larger than the middle class here in the U.S. By 2030, China will have about 1.4 billion middle class citizens compared to 365 here in the U.S. So, Hofeng, how important, I mean, that's so significant. And can you give us some understanding of what the government is thinking about these citizens, and how important is it for these citizens to have buying power to give the economy a boost in China?
Yeah, first of all, that definitely in terms of absolute numbers, China middle class has been expanding in a very significant rate. But at the same time, that we always need to put things in perspective, because even though the Chinese middle class in absolute size has been big and bigger than many countries, but China is also a very big country of 1.3 billion. So in terms of proportion, that the middle class right now is still a small proportion. That if you go to some major cities like Shanghai and Beijing and Guangzhou, of course, you find a lot of people who have a middle-class lifestyle, middle-class income, but there's also vast inland area in the rural area that many of these people's living standard is still far from a middle-class standard. I think in terms of boosting internal consumption and building up the internal domestic market for manufactured goods, I think that over the last few years, the Chinese government have done something to do that. So I think the Chinese government should continue to do it, not to expand the middle class per se, but to increase the purchasing power of the lower class, particularly in the rural areas. I think they have tried some of this policy, and it is quite successful. For example, they offer discounts to rural households to buy electrical appliances, to buy computers and things like that. And it is a small step in a good direction over the last few years. And if they continue to do it to improve the livelihood of the rural people, and also the increase the wage of the working class, I think that the goal of finding a new engine of the Chinese economy, that is the domestic consumption, can be achieved. But it is still quite a difficult task.
And then you also have a growing older population. By the middle of the century, China will have more older people, about 438 million, outnumbering the entire U.S. population. And the Guardian just ran an article that said the pensions are about $10 a month, And a lot of older people are going through the garbage to turn in like bottles and plastic and things to try to make ends meet. Katie, can you talk a little bit about the growing older population and how the government plans to deal with that?
Well, I think it's going to be a significant problem that the government has to face. One of the things that's happened is there are migrant workers, people who have left the countryside to work in the factories of the eastern coast, and especially in the southeast part of China. And these migrant workers oftentimes have not paid into the pension system. And so it's not clear what kind of pension benefits they'll get when they grow old. And there's a very high savings rate amongst Chinese families. And so one question will be, you know, when the current working group gets to retirement age, what kind of income will they have? I don't think that that's totally resolved at this point, and it could be a crisis.
That is Katie Kwan. She's Associate Chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. We're also joined by Ho-Fung Hung, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. And today we are talking about the changing economy in China. After 3 decades of growth at about 10%, the economy is expected to grow at maybe 7 to 8%. We're seeing massive worker uprisings across China. There is a scandal that hit the Communist Party. And also next month, they're going to begin the process of a once-a-decade handover of power. So there's a lot of things happening in China, and this is also a key component of the election. Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are going after each other about China, and we'll talk about that later in the show. What are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have about the Chinese economy? Do you think it's at a turning point? How will this affect the rest of the globe and the global economy? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And Katie, why don't you talk a little bit about the working class and the uprisings across China that we're seeing? The uprisings at Foxconn, where the iPads and the iPods are made, tend to get a lot of attention, but the uprisings at other organizations do not, and China Labor Watch covers this closely.
Right. Well, there are lots of labor uprisings taking place in China. I think government statistics, which are not totally reliable, I think, but, you know, talk about tens of thousands of collective disputes per year, and I think the number is probably several times that amount. And what's happening is that there's a whole range of disputes going on because as the economy transitions to a more capitalist form of economy, there are some people who are getting left behind, and the income gap is widening greatly. So what you see is you see some people getting rich through having businesses, and a lot of workers feel left behind. And there's a growing expectation among workers that they should enjoy the fruits of their work. So there have been disputes ranging from the suicides at Foxconn that are well publicized to the recent riots in Taiyuan, and but also there are strikes that are a little bit more organized, and especially in the southern province of Guangdong. The official provincial policy is that when strikes occur, that they should be resolved through collective bargaining peacefully. And also the provincial government is promoting grassroots elections of union officers or union representatives. And so what this means is that there are, you know, in this vast array of labor unrest, there is actually sort of a small group that is experimenting with international standards of labor relations through collective bargaining. And I think this is quite hopeful.
And Ho-Fung, what would you add to that? What strikes you about the worker unrest and the uprisings that we've seen in the last few months?
Yeah, I think that this increasing labor unrest has been around for the last few years, actually, in fact, is the last 10 years. I think it is amazing. At the same time, another amazing fact is that these separate individual instances of riots or uprising or strikes don't convert into a larger movement that really threaten the government. I think one reason behind it is that under the very high economic growth, the local government can still afford offering concession in as a strategy to contain the labor unrest by increasing minimum wage, improving the job security of the workers, and the local government usually a lot totally on the side of the capital. Sometimes they are also will urge the entrepreneurs to offer concession to the workers. So it is all happening under the background of high-speed economic growth of 10% or more. What I'm concerned about is that when the economy continues to slow down and there's no dramatic policy change that sustain the economic growth, that I think it is inevitable it will slow down. Once it slows down, and then whether the Chinese government will continue to be able to offer concession as a way to contain the labor unrest, and whether this kind of unrest will continue to grow to the point that it will converge to something bigger that can really change the existing system.
And Katie, how are multinationals responding to these uprisings?
Well, that's interesting because Apple, for example, has come under fire internationally for the suicides and also now the riots that have recently occurred. And I have to say that having been a part of the anti-sweatshop movement in the 1990s, I think that Apple is a little bit slow to, you know, come to terms with its social responsibility. And in the beginning, it flat out, you know, said it was Foxconn's, the contractor, its vendor in China. Foxconn's responsibility, not its responsibility, was when Steve Jobs was still alive. Mm. And now it is, it has hired on a labor monitor, the Fair Labor Association. And, you know, I think that the Fair Labor Association's report was a little bit interesting. It said that, you know, the biggest problem is still these very, very long hours of overtime work, and this is, I think, one of the biggest problems. And you know, I'm a little bit stymied as to why Apple cannot be a little bit more exacting from its vendors when it comes to labor standards. So, you know, we know that it has very high quality standards for its iPods and iPads and iPhones. But why can't it have similarly high standards for labor?
And its stock just hit $700 recently.
Right.
What is the relationship like between the Chinese government and these huge corporations like Foxconn?
Oh, well, you know, the Chinese government, you know, has, as was noted earlier, relied on these foreign investors to basically drive the economy. But it, you know, it, I think that the Chinese government has, in doing so, has basically abdicated its responsibility towards workers. And there's no reason why the Chinese government couldn't have required higher standards in its factories while inviting foreign investors in. There is still a very strong China advantage to production. Its infrastructure is good. Its workforce is educated and hardworking. And so it seems to me that the labor equation could well have been put into economic development policy.
Because these multinationals, they invested enormous amounts of money to build these low-cost supply chains, right?
Yeah, and they get a lot of perks, too. And so oftentimes when they come into an area, they will try to negotiate to not pay taxes or otherwise get other kinds of infrastructure help and other subsidies. So, the Chinese government, I think, sort of was looking at the investment without really looking at how it could wield its influence to improve things for workers.
And just before we go to break, we have just a couple of minutes, and we'll talk more about the workers and uprisings after the break. But I wanted to ask you, Ho Feng, how significant is the power handover that begins next month? China's leaders are preparing for a once-a-decade handover of power.
Yeah, I think it is a very interesting thing to watch because whether the new leaderships can stabilize things, particularly in this challenging economic situation, is really a question mark because in the last two governments head by Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin, they both has the blessing of Deng Xiaoping, which is the first-generation revolutionary leader who basically handpicked Jiang to be the leader of China in the 1990s and then handpicked Hu Jintao after Jiang. So it is the first time that the Communist Party is changing hands without the blessing or the appointment of any kind from a first-generation revolutionary leader who has highest prestige and legitimacy among the Chinese people. So how the new leaders could settle among themselves in terms of the division of the vested interests and also to convince the people they are legitimate rulers of the country to have the benefits of the people in their mind, I think it is a big challenge, particularly in these times of economic slowdown.
And Katie, what would you add to that?
Well, I think that China's leaders have now to look at which way forward. So in the past, Deng Xiaoping sort of set the tone by saying, okay, we're going to open up China and we're going to allow foreign investment and it's going to be a market society. But now the question is, what kind of market society? Is it going to be, as it's been, sort of almost lawless, sort of race to the bottom society, or is it going to be one where all of its citizens enjoy the fruits of the economy?
And how significant is this latest scandal? Bo Xilai, a member of the Communist Party Politburo, is accused of abusing power, taking massive bribes, and bearing major responsibility in relation to his wife's murder of a British businessman. Ho Feng, how significant is this?
I think that the crimes that Bo Xilai is charged of is not quite significant from the CCP standards because taking a lot of bribes and having another is like having unusual sexual relations with multiple women. I think it is very common for the high-rank officials. Everybody have to investigate it. Everybody have it. What is so important is that because Bo Xilai is a polarizing figure, many people like him, many people dislike him. What is so special about him is that he tried to do some bold things that is deviating from the collectives of the leaders. And then so far as somebody do something that want to stick out, and they will be gone after, and then it is the fate of Bo Xilai. So I think...
Well, hold that thought, Ho Feng. We're going to take a quick break. And if you have any questions or comments about the Chinese economy, what's happening there, what role do you think the relationship between China and the U.S., how do you want that to develop? 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out a weekly email newsletter that tells you what's coming up on the show and gives you resources to let you learn more and get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and can submit your questions and comments before the show goes to air. It's free and easy. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And we also invite you to participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255. 866-798-2255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And tomorrow we continue our election coverage with a debate on Proposition 32. If it passes, it would ban unions and corporations from extracting money from employee paychecks for political campaigns. Supporters say it gets special interests out of politics. Opponents say it unfairly targets unions and leaves exemptions for corporations. So we'd love to hear from you tomorrow on Prop 32. What questions do you have? And today we are talking about the current situation in China. There's a lot of things developing in China. You've got the Communist Party embroiled in a major political crisis. And next month, politicians will be going through a once-a-decade handover of power. After decades of growth at about 10%, China's economy is expected to grow at about 7 to 8%. We're seeing massive worker uprisings across China. And then, of course, China's trade relations with the U.S. have become a major economic issue in this year's presidential campaign. So what questions do you have about China? How do you want the relationship between China and the U.S. to develop? How do you understand China? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any connections with China, if you've worked there, or if you've got relatives maybe who live there, what are your thoughts on the changes that we're seeing? What do you expect in the coming decade? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Katie Kwan, Associate Chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. She's been a labor specialist there since 1998. Ho Fung Hung is Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. He is author of Protest with Chinese Characteristics, Demonstrations, Riots, and Petitions in the Ming-Qing Dynasty. And we have a question from Rob, and he wants to know, will the use of robots and factory automation replace the working population before they're ready to retire? Or will it displace huge numbers of workers? And Katie, the New York Times reported that Foxconn is kind of threatening workers, saying, well, if you keep rising up, we're going to replace you with robots. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's the same as was said to auto workers 20 or 30 years ago, when the auto companies began to introduce robots into auto factories. And now we see that this is quite common in many auto factories. I think, in fact, there will continue to be technological innovation, whether it's robots or computers or so forth. But it is often used as a threat against workers, pitted against workers, in order to make them more compliant and more fearful of losing their jobs. I think over the long run, there will continue to be, technological and mechanical updates. But, the key thing is that we will still need workers to run the robots or run the computers.
Right. And Ho Fung, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think that to be sure that automation will replace labor power, but to what extent we need to be careful because media usually tends to exaggerate this robot, like in the 1980s when there's a widespread report about Toyota using robot to assembly car, and it is turned out to be a wide exaggeration that Toyota used robot to put the parts together in the final assembling, but at the same time it also relied on a lot of outsourced small factories that is very labor intensive to make the parts and the mirrors and the car seat and things like that. So I think that in the long run, yes, robot will be more and more important and will displace labor power, but I don't see today that it is a big thing that will obliterate the lead for labor intensive part of the production, and it is easy to be exaggerated.
I will say one thing, though, is I think that it does call for a different type of training and education than people had in the past. And this goes for the United States as well as China or any place else in the world. So that if you go to China now and you look at an assembly line in an auto plant or any plant, you'll see that many workers are at computers and you have to have a different type of training on different types of machines. But there still is the need for human workers.
And Rob also had a question about senior citizens. He says, with the one child per family policy, how will the government find income to support their seniors with few workers per retiree? And Katie, do older people in China have a voice?
Older people in China, and I don't have the real statistics, but it seems to me that civil society protest about other kinds of things like housing or, you know, land grabs or other social issues tends to be heavily senior citizens.
Hmm.
And my surmise is that, you know, some of this may have to do with the current senior citizens were sort of products of the Cultural Revolution generation, where there was a lot of protest in society. But they tend to be very, very assertive. And how they will fare in the future, I think, is a big problem to tackle. If we look at Japan, where the situation is very severe, that the population that's working and contributing to the retirement system is very small compared to the huge number of older people, I think it's a pretty big crisis. And actually, the United States is facing a similar situation.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you again for the email, Rob, and you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a labor educator, colleague of Katie's. I have a question. To what extent is China its own manufacturing center? To what extent is it just one place in a global supply chain? And if the latter is true, to what extent are unions in other countries, Europe, the United States, collaborating with unions, the emerging independent labor movement in China? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, right now, the unions in the U.S., I should say the AFL-CIO does not have a formal relationship with unions in China. The second other federation in the U.S., the Change to Win, has had relations with Chinese unions, but they are, although they're formally in place, there's not much activity there. So I think that in the global economy, in a situation that the caller was just describing, where the interests of workers in a global supply chain are really in common. There's a like a worldwide labor market. Unions have not really stepped up to this global labor market and said that we ought to sort of link across borders in solidarity.
And why is that? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are some pretty strong ties between union members here and union members in South Korea. I've interviewed a number of people who go back and forth on a regular basis.
Right. There are relationships between U.S. unions, for example, and almost every other country in the world. The two large exceptions are China, which has the largest number of working people in the world, and Cuba. And both Cuba and China are socialist countries. And so I think that this has to do with some Cold War politics that are sort of left over. And this is kind of unfortunate because, in actuality, if you go to China, I mean, you really see that it's pretty capitalist.
Right.
And that economic, while politically folks may be in a Cold War mentality, economically it's really in workers' interests to link together.
Right. What would the possibilities be, Ho Fung, if there was solidarity between U.S. unions and Chinese workers?
Yeah, I think that I'm not a particular expert on this issue, but I think that to build, beside building solidarity between U.S. and Chinese workers, maybe we also need to look at the solidarity among U.S. Chinese workers and also the workers in Cambodia and Vietnam and Bangladesh, because what we can see is that when the labor wage in China is going up, many increasing number of factories in China are moving to other countries. And also some Chinese enterprise, including Chinese state enterprise and private enterprise, are doing outsourcing to other Southeast Asian countries and also to South Africa and other African countries. So if we only have the solidarity of labor movement between the U.S. and China, then it will improve the standard in the Chinese factories, and then but if there's other parts of the world in which the labor is a lot protected, the factories will just go there, and then it will be kind of an endless race to the bottom.
All right, well, thank you for the call, Bill. Let's hear next from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max, welcome to the show.
Good morning, thank you for a good program.
Thank you. Hi, Max, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Go ahead.
You hear me?
Yes.
Thank you for a good program and for taking my call. I have a straightforward question. Well, of course, there's a lot of bashing of China. I was thinking of the bashing done by Mr. Romney.
Mm.
But how much of the deficit, the trade deficit between the two countries, how much of it is attributable to intra-company trade involving, of course, American parent companies and their subsidiaries and or branches in China? Thank you very much for your answer. Take it off the air.
Thank you. Who would like to take that one?
I'll defer.
Ho Fung?
Is it the about intra-company trade?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I don't have the figures, but I think that even, for example, the relation between Foxconn and Apple and the relation between all the suppliers of Walmart and Target, they are a lot regarded as an intra-company trade because basically they are, for example, in all these big retailers, they have these trading firms who do sourcing in China and Asia and then find factories and then they sign a short-term contract to supply to the trading company that in turn sell the merchandise to Target, Walmart, or other companies. Kind of big retailers. So even though these factories are manufacturing for the big retailers in the U.S., but they are a lot intra-company trade and they are still trade between different companies, one in Asia and China and one in the U.S. So it is how the supply chain works, that it is not intra-company trade. So the retailers don't need to theoretically take responsibility for the working conditions of the workers in the factory that produce the goods for them, even though they are actually producing the goods for them. And their price structures and their price strategy actually affect the working condition there. But in theoretically speaking, that these factories are operating independently, separately from the retailers. I think it is also the relation between Apple and Foxconn that they are legally separate companies.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Max. And we have a question from a listener about Chinese foreign policy. How is China using other countries to feed its people by buying agricultural lands, for example, in Africa? Do you know, Ho Fung?
For agricultural land, I'm not that sure whether it is a major trend because, of course, there's a lot of land grabs going on in Africa right now, but as far as I know, that many of these land grabs happen because of this hedge fund and financial operation based in Wall Street and in European and North American countries. China, I think that it might take part in it, but it is not yet a big part. In terms of foreign policy, I think what China really worry about is the supply of petroleums and all other kind of natural gases and natural resources that sustain its steady economic growth. So its foreign policy towards Central Asia and Southeast Asia and Africa is pretty much determined by its
attempt to secure the supply of natural resources. That because right now many trade routes along which the Middle Eastern oil are shipped to China go through many strategic choke points, like the Strait of Malacca, that is actually under the control of U.S. military. For example, U.S. has a military alliance with Singapore, so the Strait of Malacca is pretty much patrolled by this alliance. So China always feels very insecure, so it wants to expand its relationship with, for example, Myanmar, to make sure that there is alternative route that the energy can go into China through a different route, bypassing the choke point controlled by the U.S. And also the same thing applied to China's attempt to establish deeper relationship with Central Asian countries. So that Chinese foreign policy with other developing countries, particularly resource-rich countries, is very much driven by its hunger for resources.
And that is Ho-Fung Hung, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, author of Protest with Chinese Characteristics. We're also joined by Katie Kwan, Associate Chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. She's been a specialist there since 1998. And now I would like to welcome Kevin Slayton to the show. Kevin is with China Labor Watch, an independent nonprofit organization that's collaborated with labor organizations to conduct in-depth assessments of factories in China making the stuff that almost all of us buy. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. So based on what you're seeing with the uprisings and the change in economics in terms of the growth dropping and profits dropping, do you think the Chinese economy is at a major turning point?
I think that this is the protests and the riots and really the pressure put on workers that we've seen in just the past few months is not something that is new in China. Whether or not the greater economic the macroeconomic situation is changing. I think this pressure is not new, and so I'm not sure that it's changing. That those things in particular are changing the dynamics of labor disputes or worker politics. What is changing is some social factors, but I don't think the economic factors have changed the face of it too much.
What social factors exactly?
One of the main ones when it comes to worker protest is the age and the consciousness of these workers. In China, there's a different generations. The people are split, often understood to split between the generations born in the 80s and the 90s. And there's a new generation born after the 90s that has a much different consciousness, and much different than their parents before them, who used to work in factories or who are also migrant workers. And these workers are more demanding. They've had a little bit different life than their parents, and they're less willing to take abuse. And at the same time, they're still very young, so they're maybe more daring in some cases to fight for their rights.
And we've got just about 9 minutes left, so if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about the changes that we're seeing in China. What are your thoughts on this? How do you want the U.S.-China relationship to develop from here? What changes would you like to see? If you have any connections to China, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have any just overall questions about what China is facing now, the number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Kevin, can you give us a sense of just, I'm trying to picture what the interaction looks like between, you know, the different classes in China, because I think it was the BBC ran this kind of surreal piece recently about how all of these high-end companies are going to China and selling, you know, really expensive wine and jewelry and things. And then you have these workers making, you know, a couple of dollars a day who are now rising up. Can you just give us a sense of what the relationships between these different classes look like and how does it function on a regular basis?
In the cities that I've been in and I've lived in China, it's very divided. I think... It's almost astounding sometimes that you'd be on the same road and you'd see migrant workers who are very responsible for the building of these new beautiful Chinese cities that we see all over China. They're responsible for building these cities and they're on these same large streets doing the work, but at the same time, you know that they're going to go back to a small, you know, trailer where they stay temporarily until they finish their work, and then they go back to the rural areas or they find another place to work. And on that road, you have people who are benefiting from this, but who make, you know, many, many hundreds of times the income, or at least tens of times the income of those people. And I think that it's a very astounding difference that you see all over China. And of course, that doesn't leave out the factories. It's the same thing. Just the factories are maybe, to the public eye, it's a little bit less visual. It's a little bit less apparent because you can't see it just traveling there.
Right.
But it is the same situation.
What about healthcare? A listener wanted to know about the healthcare system in China.
What aspects of it?
Well, is it available? Who has it?
Healthcare, in terms of workers in the factories, it can be provided through the employers, but it's not always provided. And one of the main, one of the big issues that China Labor Watch talks about in a lot of our reports is that workers will promise this healthcare, or it's part of the package that the workers are supposed to get as in their contract, but then it's not actually given to them. And so it's in a way similar to America or other countries, sometimes healthcare is attached to the employer, but you don't always get it. And even the workers in China might pay a fee for this social insurance or for their healthcare and not actually get the full service. And that's a real concern among us who and other people who focus on Chinese labor.
So what happens if they get sick on the job?
It depends on the employer, of course, but there's many stories that we've published before and testimony of workers who will get sick, but they can't actually take off, or if they take off, they have wages taken, despite the fact that they're supposed to have a sick day, or despite the fact that, you know, they're very sick and they really can't work efficiently. It really depends on where they're working, but there's a lot of supplier factories and a lot of factories in general in China that the management is just very, very, very strict, and strict to an extent that these workers can't even get a sick day. It's not really accepted.
Another listener who couldn't stand the line wanted to know what the minimum wage is in China.
There's minimum wages are often seen in regional lenses. So it depends on the city you're in and the particular region. Recently there was a report we did on a factory in Tianjin, and the minimum wage there, I think, was something like 900, or maybe it's gone over 1,000 now. Maybe it's something like 1,200 renminbi a month. That's roughly divided by six, so maybe 200 U.S. dollars a month. Now, this is a base wage that these workers are required to get in a lot of these cities, and the base wage is deceiving. It's very low, but it's deceiving because the workers will make more, but they do it through overtime and a lot of overtime. And this is the largest abuse that we talked about, that we've been talking about a lot, and I think a lot of people talk about this issue, that workers are working up to 100 hours, more than 100 hours of overtime a month because their base wages are so low that it's not a living wage in a city, and they have to work this much overtime to even be able to live any sort of life in a city.
And do you think, does solidarity from other countries, is the message sent back to China? There are organizations like Change.org giving petitions to Apple to treat workers better. People are trying to express solidarity, but does that reach the Chinese workers?
I think that we have to, if you're talking about in a general sort of sense of the movements in the West to try to use these different tools we have, these social tools, I think you have to go through a sort of a mediary, like pressure on a company. Sure, it's not going to be very easy for the typical consumer, your Apple iPhone buyer, to go talk to their worker in China, but there are ways to put pressure, and there are ways to affect that change. And one of them is putting pressure on the company that is making those products. If I can chime in on a thing that was said earlier, I heard the last guest, the professor, talking about responsibility of British brand companies. And yes, legally and maybe theoretically, you can argue that there's no responsibility of these brand companies for the treatment of these workers in the factories because they're supplier companies. But the very reason that a lot of these brand companies choose these supplier factors is because the responsibility is a little bit separated. It's not as direct. And I think that's something we need to be focused on, and we need to put pressure on these brand companies to take responsibility, even if they're not legally obliged to do it, because they know what these workers are doing and how they're being treated, and so do we.
And final thoughts from you, Katie, on, I guess, maybe what are your thoughts on the future of the Chinese-U.S. relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I wanted to add to what the last speaker said.
Sure.
I think that the consumer movements of the 1990s where people were outraged that, for example, Kathy Lee Gifford's products were produced in sweatshops in Central America, and Nike's products were being produced under inhumane circumstances, I think led to a situation where corporations did have to adopt codes of conduct and did have to set into place monitoring to make sure that their goods were produced humanely. Now, maybe there wasn't a huge revolution in labor standards as a result of that, but it did, I think, stop the worst forms of exploitation.
Mm.
And so consumer movements, I do think, have a strong influence on these large multinational corporations like Apple or Nike or whatever.
And what does it have an influence on the Communist Party, do you think?
Well, I think that in turn, the Nike and Reebok, when they go into a country, then they have to say, well, you know, we have codes of conduct that we have to abide by. And no matter, and this happened in China, for example, Reebok said that at one point, it says, well, you know, you may not have to have elections of union officers in your plants, but in our Reebok supplier, we're going to conduct elections because this is according to our codes of conduct. So in many cases, corporations can play a pushing role on labor standards in a country despite what the government policy is.
And they'll only do that if they hear from their customers.
That's right.
Right.
I very much agree with what Katie just said. I think corporations have so much ability to change these situations because they are the customer of these supplier factories. Again, you can separate yourself legally, but the corporations have so much influence. And if they want to take it upon themselves to change the situations. An industry-wide movement, for example, can absolutely change the face of Chinese labor.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Kevin Slayton is with China Labor Watch. Katie Kwan, Associate Chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley, and Ho-Fung Hung is Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What are the best ways to limit big money's influence on politics in California? On the next Your Call, we continue our election coverage with a debate on Proposition 32. If it passes, it would ban unions and corporations from extracting money from employee paychecks for political campaigns. Supporters say it gets special interests out of politics. Opponents say it unfairly targets unions and leaves exemptions for corporations. What do you want to know about Prop 32? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.